Today on Masters of Austrian Economics, we'll be focusing on the contributions of Murray N. Rothbard, a man who kept the flame of the Austrian school alive during its darkest hours in the 1960s. He wrote a lot of books, but his interests were somewhat varied. Arguably, he was chiefly an economic historian. His PhD thesis was on the Panic of 1819, which remains the seminal study of that episode. Likewise, his work on the Great Depression and on the history of banking in the USA is exceptionally detailed. The four-volume Conceived in Liberty is an exhaustive economic history of the American colonies prior to the War for Independence. And late in his career, he wrote a comprehensive history of economic thought, starting with the ancient world and running until Bastiat in the mid-19th century. The Progressive Era, published posthumously, is an economic history of the US from the late 1890s to the 1920s. Apart from this work as a historian, he was also, of course, a great political activist and a foundational member of the modern American libertarian movement. Books like For a New Liberty and The Ethics of Liberty are works of political philosophy outlining his vision for the free society. In this series, however, I am only concerned with economic theory, and in this regard, Rothbard's contributions are confined to his masterpiece of Austrian synthesis, Man, Economy and State. Its sequel, Power and Market, originally published separately, but now included as part of the main book, and then a book which was called The Logic of Action, but is now published as Economic Controversies. This collects Rothbard's scholarly economic essays and serves chiefly to clarify specific points of Austrian theory or to address criticisms of either Mises or Man, Economy and State. For the most part, Rothbard is a strict disciple of Ludwig von Mises, and if you have not yet seen the previous video in this series, I recommend you do so before continuing. But Rothbard departs from Mises on two crucial issues, which are considered his original contributions to Austrian theory. The first is in the area of production theory, and especially cost theory, which was underdeveloped in Mises. And the second is his distinctive theory of monopoly. To understand Rothbard's production theory, first we need to understand what he was disagreeing with, namely the neoclassical view of price formation. Neoclassical economists, such as, for example, the Chicago School, as embodied in someone like George Stigler, view production in the firm a little bit like a black box. Inputs go in, and these are the firm's costs. Outputs come out, and these generate the firm's revenue. The price must be set above the costs in order to make a profit. This view is chiefly derived from Alfred Marshall, who famously used the analogy of a pair of scissors. Prices, he said, are determined by two blades of the scissors. On one blade, there are the subjective valuations of the customers, and on the other, there are the objective real costs of production. In the short run, he said, it is the consumer's tastes and the level of demand that determines the price. But in the long run, when the market becomes more settled, the costs of production emerge as the real factor determining the price. In this way, Marshall saved the classical economists like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and John Stuart Mill from the onslaught of the marginal revolution and subjective theory of value. That is, he found a way to smuggle in a new version of the labour theory of value back into his cost theory. Now, on the face of it, you might think that this sounds like common sense. Sure, the costs of production do determine the price, no? And if you look at the actual data, adjusting for inflation, Marshall seems correct, at least superficially, that price fluctuations settle down and hover just around the cost of production, as you can see from this comparison of British consumer prices from 1973 compared with prices from 2019. As an aside, these numbers don't tell the whole story. The total British workforce in 1973 was around 21.3 million, and they were mostly men supporting a family on one wage. The average wage, adjusted for inflation using today's money, was £475. In 2019, the workforce is 32.75 million, and both men and women work, very often bringing home two wages for the household. The average wage is £532. Total consumer demand is around 53.75% higher today than it was in 1973. So what does this tell us? The real prices of those goods, by which I mean their relative costs to the total amount of income consumers have, has dropped, even though it looks like they've stayed relatively constant. In 1913, the average cost of a loaf of bread was 0.94% of the average weekly wages. In 1973, that figure had fallen to 0.18% of weekly wages. In 2019, for a man supporting a family alone, it has actually risen very slightly to 0.19%. But when you consider that it is much more normal now for two parents to be working, the figure for the household is more like 0.094%. It's likely per unit cost of production has come down as well in 40 years. But this is clearly not the thing determining the prices. Look at the price of stalk margarine then. That has doubled. Why? It is because margarine was all the rage in the 1970s, but now butter has made a massive comeback. That means that there are fewer players in the margarine market, and it's more of a niche item, so the price has doubled. But undoubtedly, the per unit cost of stalk margarine, given 40 years of technological development, is much less now than it was in 1973. It's supply and demand determining the price, not the production cost. Anyway, this is not the sort of analysis that Rothbard would make. To combat Alfred Marshall's mistake, which endures to this day in neoclassical economics, Rothbard combined Bom Baverk's intertemporal structure of production with Frank Fetter's pure time preference theory of interest. And he then applied these two ideas to the marginal productivity theory, which had been developed by John Bates Clark in the US and Philip Wicksteed in the UK. First of all, remember that interest accrues because one party is selling a present good, money in exchange, for a future good, money in 3 months' time. A present good, let us say a fish, will always be worth more than a future good, the prospect of a fish in 1 week. Let us return to our favourite baker from a couple of episodes back. As you will recall, he was pumping out 150 loaves of bread a day, and he worked out his costs as shown. But how are these costs determined? In his role as the buyer of the factors of production, the baker is purchasing the prospect of future goods with a present good, money. In his role as the seller of bread, he is selling a present good, bread, in exchange for a present good, money. Now he hopes to sell all of his bread to make 225 gold pieces. From this, he can work backwards to figure out how much he should be spending on each of his factors of production. The fixed capital, that's the oven, which costs 4,000 gold pieces, that money simply forsaken. He's invested that, and he can only get that money back through sales. His other costs, the variable capital, that is the ingredients for the bread and the labour, are much like this as well. But he has to work those out on an ongoing basis. That is, he has to keep paying the workers, buying flour from day to day and week to week. To make 150 units, he knows he needs two workers, 10 packs of flour and 10 packs of baking soda. He can work out the marginal revenue product for each factor by isolating it. For example, if we take out the second worker, we can see that the first worker is helping to generate 120 gold pieces. The first worker, therefore, can be paid no more than 120 gold pieces, and the second worker no more than 105 gold pieces. Likewise, we can do the same with the 10th unit of flour. By removing this, we can see that 22.5 gold pieces of potential revenue will be lost. And it will also make the 10th unit of baking soda redundant, reducing its marginal value to zero. The combined price, therefore, of the 10th unit of flour and the 10th unit of baking soda can be no more than 22.5 gold pieces combined. If we put all of these values into our formula, one can see immediately that we end up with double the costs of the projected revenue. This won't do at all. So naturally, we must halve all of these numbers. This is because half of the revenue product is coming from the flour and the baking soda, and half from the worker. That is, baking soda and flour doesn't bake itself into bread, and workers without any ingredients cannot magic bread out of thin air. And so we end up with the real marginal revenue product for each factor. But remember, our baker is not going to be paying the full marginal revenue product for these factors because the revenue is only in prospect. That is, it is a future good. And he's paying for each of these things with a present good, money. Therefore, he will pay a discounted price for them, the discounted marginal revenue product, to compensate for the differing time preferences of himself and those he is paying for future goods. Now, whatever this discounted marginal revenue product will be is established on the market. The baker goes to the farmer for the flour and knows he wishes to pay less than 56.25 gold pieces for 10 packs. The farmer will have a bottom price in mind, unknown to the baker. They come to a deal. The baker gets the flour, a component for a prospective future good, for 30 gold pieces. The negotiation with the worker happens in exactly the same way. The worker is selling labor, a component for a prospective future good, rather than flour. And the baker has established on the market the actual prices for his discounted marginal revenue product. Let's see how his week goes, shall we? Well, not bad. He's made profit some days, he's drew even on some days, and he's made a loss on others. But overall, he's made 321 gold pieces for the week. He allows himself to start dreaming of buying a second oven to double his production capacity. But the farmer has got wind of the baker making a killing this week and feels that he deserves a piece of the action as the supplier of the flour. The worker, seeing how busy it has been, also senses that he could be making more money. He too starts dreaming of being an independent baker one day. He could get himself an oven in less than 6 months. So the next week, the baker goes to buy the flour. He is faced with a higher price. He also gives in to the worker and pays him a bit more, figuring that the worker is worth a good deal more to him than he is being paid in any case. So his costs for the next week have changed, but he sees no need to change the price given how things went relatively well last week. Why change a winning formula? He'll just make marginally less profit, he figures. Oh dear, things haven't gone quite as well this week. It'll take a little bit longer to get that second oven. But now the baker might think about dropping the price of bread to try to boost sales. Of course, if sales don't pick up, he's going to have to look to cut costs or else go bust. But hopefully you can see it is not the cost of production determining the price. So let us recap. The marginal revenue product, RMP, is the projected future revenue generated by one factor of production. The discounted marginal revenue product, meanwhile, is the lower price paid by the capitalist in present goods, money, for future goods, future revenue, for one factor of production. The capitalist also takes on entrepreneurial risk as the bearer of uncertainty. That is, he could make a profit or a loss. Cost of production does not determine the final price which is always determined ultimately by the consumer. I will turn now to Rothbard's monopoly theory. Let us stick with the bread market and say there are four firms with roughly equal market share. Baker's Inc. develops a new robot which can automate the kneading of dough. This means he can drop his price down to one gold piece. As per Hayek, he has permanently changed the structure of production by saving up and investing in this way. Note, this is not cost of production determining price, because if you factor in the money that Baker's Inc. spent on the new robot, he has actually spent more on production than his competitors. Anyway, this new low price helps him to steal away customers from the other bakery firms. He now has an 80% market share. Soon enough, he's able to drop to 0.75 gold pieces for a loaf of bread, and the other players are driven out of the market. Baker's Inc. now have a 100% monopoly. Rothbard argues that there's nothing inherently bad about this because consumers are getting great bargain prices. This is a monopoly of efficiency. Baker's Inc. are the last firm standing because they had the best product at the best price. The consumers have voted out the other bakers out of existence. However, if our man starts getting cocky and trying to sneak up the price in the thought that he now has the luxury of a monopoly, soon enough, new competitors will enter the market and undercut him. He will gradually lose market share until there's a new market leader who can sell at the old price, assuming consumer preferences have not changed. Rothbard argues that in this way, a monopoly can only sustain itself on the free market if it is truly an efficiency monopoly. Any attempt to price gouge will be punished by competition, and examples from real history are plentiful in this regard. Rothbard's favorite example is James J. Hill, a railroad tycoon who single-handedly undercut and took down an entire cartel, and he did it through entirely peaceful means, legally buying land, laying track, and even ensuring that Native Americans agree to it through trading with them, unlike the US government, incidentally, who later literally just killed Native Americans who stood in the way of their plans. In any case, the only way for a monopoly to sustain itself, argues Rothbard, is through government intervention. For a true monopoly, a firm needs some mechanism of legally keeping other firms from entering the market. Rothbard outlines 14 different methods by which this might be achieved. These include cartelization, production quotas, licenses, quality standards, tariffs, immigration restriction, child labor laws, minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, compulsory unionism, conscription, government penalties such as antitrust, opening hour laws, taxes and so on, conservation laws, patents. Let's go back to our bread market. Imagine that the government introduces a new bakery license which costs 10,000 gold pieces. The biggest players in the market might easily afford this, but the smaller players likely not. Remember that worker who was dreaming of buying his own oven? Now it would take him over 2 years to save up just to buy a license. The barrier to entry is significantly raised, and so the market leaders consolidate their position and marginal players are driven out. The government might also decree that bread production must meet certain standards. And again, this favours the existing market leaders who can afford to comply with this new demand. Similarly, a patent can be used to lock out competition, and the legal costs or opportunity costs for gaining the knowledge to apply for one of these favours the larger firm. Governments often form committees and regulatory bodies and invite comment from the market leading firms to have their say on what they think should be done. Yeah, workers' unions can agitate for higher pay, and governments can come down on their side. Again, the biggest firms can pay, but the marginal firms more likely cannot. Not only will the larger firm absorb the costs, But with a captive market and possibly to offset the new costs, they can also raise their prices. The regulatory barriers cushion the blow for them. Once these firms are big enough, they can lobby the government to give them special protections. Let's pretend that the new higher price of bread is causing cheaper foreign transports to be bought instead. The government can slap a big tariff on the imports in a bid to protect the large firms. And so these firms have even more of a captive market and can raise prices if they so wished, protected from competition as they are. However, if they push it too high, this might result in the government stepping in on behalf of the public and issuing a price control. Now there is a more uniform price in the bread market. There's only two brands to choose from. Brands who have little to no incentive to innovate or invest when they can simply rake in money from guaranteed sales of bread. Assuming that consumers haven't switched to some other product. If too many people get wind of this, there may be agitation for an antitrust case to be brought against these government-created behemoths. Maybe one of them can afford to settle out of court, and the other one vows to fight in court. The case will only ever be lost by the company. So now Baker Bros has been trust-busted and exists as three smaller regional companies. But still, the public is stuck with bread at three gold pieces, owing to all the other regulations we've seen. So, to recap, according to Rothbard, an efficiency monopoly is not a bad thing, since consumers get cheaper prices as long as the monopolistic firm stays efficient. A monopoly that tries to raise its prices above the market rate will not sustain for long in free market conditions. True monopolies must rely on violent government interventions to sustain. Next time on Masters of Austrian Economics, Hans Hermann Hopper. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Stetson F. Lionel, The Ambivalent Onion, Christopher Scholholm, The Crimson Satyr, Chris, Kieran Haywood, Mr. A.M. Swainson, Radical Liberation, The Binary Surfer, Tragic Vision, Bailey and Aurora, Toyotomi Ami, Holy Spatula, Alexander, Froggy, Splice, Buck Hugit Society, Michael Meir, Jay Greenriver, Michael Tynan, Heronius Napalm V, Vincenzo Rapio, and Edward Darrow.